Hello and welcome to No Direction's official PaizoCon 2019 seminar coverage in partnership with Paizo. Today's seminar is Secrets of Galarian with speakers James Jacobs, Ron Lundeen, and John Compton. Our coverage would not be possible without the help of our con staff, Paizo, and our patrons. Find more seminar recordings on NoDirectionPodcast.com.
Do that too.
Oh, good.
Yeah, all right.
Secrets of Galarian. If it's Secrets of Starfinder, I'll make stuff up and it will not be canon and Rob will yell at me, so. Who are you?
Hi, my name is John Compton. I'm the Organized Play lead developer. So all things Pathfinder Society, Starfinder Society, and the like, and done a lot of writing on other projects as well.
I'm James Jacobs. I'm the Pathfinder Creative Director, and yeah, that's me.
So we're basically here to be answering any of the questions that you have, or Param, are we pulling audience or stream questions as well? Fantastic. That come up, just as a heads up, as is tradition, no, we do not answer questions about what happened to Eridan. But otherwise, yeah, we're pretty open.
Yeah, and it's really, we've always run this traditionally just as a question-answer thing, and like John was saying, it's open. We won't say which questions you should ask, but if you ask the right questions, we might reveal something we didn't think we would.
Yeah, it can surprise us too, yeah. Partway through.
So, yeah, so let's get going. Questions. Uh-oh.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now this is going to be interesting, because it's all like for the real internet out there. People come up and...
Yeah, you do want me here, right? All right.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so I was reading about elementals, and it says Raginori was sealed because he was in a squabble with another good aligned elemental lord for teaching mortals metalcraft or how to use metal weapons. Because Raginori didn't like that. Raginori, the good aligned deity of fire, taught mortals how to forge metal weapons, and Raginori was like, "You should have done that." And they got a squabble and then were sealed because they weren't able to band together. So there were no metal weapons before then? Like, that was during the Age of Serpents?
I can start this.
Sure.
When we first started coming up with all the demigods and stuff for Galarian, one of the things I really wanted to do was to avoid completely doing everything that Dungeons and Dragons had done before at those early days. And I also have this compulsion to fight against symmetries and all that. So originally, that's why all of the good elemental lords were either dead or banished or gone, and just the bad guys were around. And then John came up with a cool idea that was too awesome to avoid, and having these people, these elementals, come back, and largely in Pathfinder Society is when it started.
And really, just the one. Only Raginori is even remotely back, even though it's spurred on interest in bringing back Atreya, Lysianasa, and...
I don't even remember the names.
Nope,
the
Earth one. Sarazul, that's
yeah.
The one.
But it's in a case like those, whether it's like ancient mythology about like who taught who, you know, metalworking, or another one that comes up a lot is Asmodeus and Ice, you know, whether or not they were the ones that created reality and all of that. It's a weird sort of thing we have to straddle when we're talking about, like, there's three goblins in the room and they have like a torch, and that's just a fact that we're telling you and the GM has to play with. But when it gets to like the mythology of the world creation, we want to create myths that actually sound like they could be real, they could not be real. So in a lot of cases, something like that, we will keep it to the GM as to whether or not that's even a true myth, whether there were metal weapons before then.
Intentional vagueness.
Yeah. And the scope of the cosmos is so vast that when we're talking about these like CR-28 demigods, that Raginori is not making the call as to whether or not mortals get metal.
Yeah.
But the notion that is true for like a star system is pretty damn cool. And so whenever we have these creation myths, the idea of, oh, this is what could have been true for this area, and by extension, when you are a GM, what could have been true for your campaign setting, or version of our campaign setting, that's more versatility for you to work with.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. Cool.
I have a question from Twitch. This one is from Seth the Sloth 2, not to be confused with Seth the Sloth 1.
Oh, okay.
Why did the gnomes leave the first world?
So there is an entry, basically one of those interstitial chapter sections in the The Fae campaign setting book of First World, it's like number 101, I think, in our publications, that covers why gnomes are most believed to have left. And it was a big, cool reveal, roughly page 19. It's pretty great. No, I was really excited when this was happening. Like, when I first arrived at Paizo, I was like, man, gnomes are little pieces of trash, aren't they? And then I realized that actually there were a lot of people who were like, man, gnomes are silly. I don't like them. I was like, no, that can't be possible. I have to defend gnomes now. And now I'm kind of the one who keeps on leading on them. So I think the gnomes
are awesome.
Cool.
I'm not in the gnomes are silly camp. Gnomes are awesome.
Oh, good, you come around, yeah.
No, I've always been around.
That's not what you said when we started the Elemental Evil campaign. either way.
I'm mean to all my players.
That is true. But either way, yeah, so there is a cool development in that book. In short, gnomes were fae, and fae had their sort of infinite cycle of, oh, hey, I fell off a cliff. Wasn't that funny? I guess I get reborn on Tuesday. And at some point, the gnomes decide to create their own mini cycle of souls as encouraged by one of the eldest. And Phrasma caught on and said, you want to play that game? You want to play that game? Fine, we'll play that game. You're on the material plane now. And took that group of gnomes that was part of that experiment and threw them out and said, you're part of my world now. You're out of the first world. And there are, if you look closely enough, some clues as to who that eldest was and who that eldest is now, who shows up in several different product lines and gets some really great lines.
Next question.
So I guess it's more of a general question. So obviously Starfinder took a lot of inspiration from Pathfinder and Galorian setting. Has there been anything that you've that Galorian has taken back from Starfinder of like, oh, that's really cool. Let's say it's still happening, you know, back in Galorian times.
Just yesterday, I'm working on an adventure called Against the Scarlet Triad. It's part 5 of The Age of Ashes, and it's written by a brilliant, brilliant author, Sean Compton. One of the things that's going on there, it takes place in Katapesh. Mm-hmm. And Katapesh is the city and the nation. And Katapesh is run by the Packmasters, which are these kind of creepy, witch-weird, alien-type things. And they picked up the witch-weirds for Starfinder because they're a good fit.
Right.
There's a big article. There's a big article in there about like the ecology of the witch-weirds and stuff like that. And one of the illustrations, I was just writing the art brief for yesterday, and I'm looking through the illustration, I was like, a witch-weird starship is illustrated in this article just to show like how they're flying around. And it's like, I bet we have something like that in Starfinder. So I started talking to Rob, looking through a bunch of stuff. And it's, oh yeah, there's a witch weird thing here that looks like their hats. And they fly around and they're like hat-shaped spaceships. And like, I did all this legwork and everything. And I got down and I started typing it in. And I realized Patrick Rennie, who works on it as well, had already done all that legwork. So, yay, he's doing my job for me. Actually, it was his job, and I didn't have to do it for him. But anyway, yeah, that's a immediate yesterday example of how stuff in Starfinder goes back in a Pathfinder.
Oh, by the way, Ron Lundin's here.
So. Yeah, and working on those various articles and adventures, it was like, okay, what do we know about witchweirds? Oh gosh, we have more in Starfinder than we do in Pathfinder about witchweirds. So there's a lot of cross-pollination in that regard. Because the more that is true between the two, the nicer.
But that's also part of the reason why we have the gap. And the gap exists to, that's the Starfinder version of what happened to Eridan. We'll never explain what the gap is. I will say this, the gap is there to help people working on Starfinder not have to be completely versed in Pathfinder and vice versa. So anything that we do in Starfinder and Pathfinder doesn't necessarily have to line up. If it does, awesome. If it doesn't, the gap.
Cool. From Twitch, Piratey Steve asks, who is the new Hurricane King in the Shackles?
It is, what's her name?
Tessa Fairwind.
Fantastic.
Yeah, that's one of the things that we're going to be talking about the evolution of Galarian in another seminar, and that's when we'll talk about how Galarian has evolved with the new edition of game, and we're basically taking all of the previous adventure paths and assuming they've happened. And the generic one is Tessa Fairwind is the new Hurricane King, Hurricane Queen, unless in your particular game one of your player characters took that job, or somebody else did.
One of the things I want to add is that we didn't just go through all the APs and go, what does success look like? What does success look like? What does success? We put some thought into, nor did we say, what does failure look like? What does failure look like? We went to put some thought into, how might this end in a way that shows that it happened in our world, but provides a springboard for different or new adventure?
Yeah.
Earlier, you guys had mentioned creation myths and how, like, there's a whole bunch. You don't want to, like, you know, go in all in on one, on, you know, a particular one. Recently, Pathfinder on official Discord, I heard that one is, like, kind of really more fleshed out. I think it's Asmodeus and Ias. How to say that?
Ias.
Ias. Could you guys, like, detail that a bit and, like, could that one be it?
Well,
you could
one
say
reason
it all?
That one's more fleshed out is that it's the first one we did, and so it just had more gravity accrete onto it. I don't know if you have much more to say.
Absolutely,
you just did a lot more stuff with
Concordance of Rivals.
Concordance of Rivals, yeah,
yeah, yeah. One of the earlier campaign setting books I read was Book of the Damned, Volume 1, in which Wes had done a whole bunch of the creation myths with Asmodeus and Ehis and how law and chaos and all this stuff, and I thought that was absolutely lovely. So when it came time to do Concordance of Rivals, I was really excited to get in some more chunks of that, as written by Tabris, who, depending upon who you ask, is either, oh gosh, he's seen some things, he knows the truth, or he's seen some things and he was kind of Herodotus and may have actually gotten drunk in a tavern in like backwaters of Maelstrom and said, oh, yeah. Herodotus, when you look deeply enough, is both absolutely amazing and also utterly absurd because he'll be... Sometimes the guess is like he didn't get any farther than Ionia before finding a bar, getting drunk, and being like, oh, did you know in Egypt that there are like giant creatures in the river? Also, everything is backwards land. The women pee standing up and the men pee sit down. And like, buddy, shh. So depending upon who you ask, Tabris is either the great truth speaker or is Captain Yahoo. I am very much in favor of the former. There are five new sections of Tabris's writing that show up in the Concordance of Rivals that talk about how Tabris presents the creation of the multiverse, what hints of what was before the multiverse, and what survived, and how ultimately the multiverse will end, as well as a final sign-off from Tabris in the Concordance of Rivals, which was the third of the three books that he wrote, in which he basically says, look, in going through all of this, I learned some things, I wrote some things, and in the end, I couldn't even read all the things I'd written because I, in a moment of elucidation, was able to read it and write it, but it is escaping me now, and I don't know what there is. Something more here that is beyond my ability as a, not even a fallen angel, but a failed angel to grok. And there are some real cool hints in there as to what that might be and how you can adapt it into your own campaign setting for what your own personal truth is. So definitely pick up the book, check it out, because it's I really like the one of the story notions of when the universe, when the multiverse is exploding ultimately and it pops like a soap bubble. A soap bubble is instantaneous. The multiverse is immense, and so it would take thousands of years for the soap bubble to collapse. But while it's happening, gods are dying. And just the notion of you being on a mortal world, and you're like, I worship Caden Kalian. Today is Tuesday. I'm going to get my spell. What happened to my god? Oh no! And there's just the question. Well, let's go to Elysium and figure out. Oh, why is Elysium fading from existence? And just all the terrible stuff that you could have happen in that sort of campaign setting. I really want to run that sort of post-apocalyptic deal. I've been babbling for a while. What should other people say?
As for Asmodeus and Ias, I will point out that if there's any of the core 20 deities you probably should not ever take at his word, it's Asmodeus. So tread carefully on trusting exactly what he says is true and
details.
Details. I mean,
don't
we
trust
all kind
the
of
Prince of Lies.
Yeah, that's just that doesn't mean anything. Let's do another question.
Sure. From Twitch, Shadzar asks, other games have had world-shattering events as editions change. Will anything like that happen to shift to Pathfinder 2? Will it have any sort of time of troubles?
No.
All right.
These questions are also good.
To get into that a little bit more, we are really proud of what we've done with Galarian, and we have a lot more stuff to say, so it doesn't make sense to blow it up. Like what Ron was saying, we looked at our adventure paths and how they can go forward in an organic matter. But I really, my personal feeling is that if you are, if a character is in world, they won't notice the addition change. Yep.
Is Zonkuthon really Dubral, or is Dubral still out in wherever, and Zonkuthon is the alien presence?
Oh, so, yes, he is. And part of that is we revealed that a little bit in the hardcover Book of the Damned. I'm not sure if you did anything in Concordance of Rivals.
I did not touch that.
Okay.
I don't think
so. We've dropped in a few more hints in Cradle of Night. At one point, I was going to have an adventure called Sanctum of the Shadow Giants, and that was going to be one of the last first edition adventures that we were going to do, and it didn't pan out. But the idea there was that it would be sort of like an Against the Giants style adventure where you go into this the Sanctum of Shadow Giants and find out the entire history of Dubral and Zonkuthon, like kind of laid out in bas relief on the walls or in old whatever ghosts and stuff like that. It didn't pan out, so that information kind of got into like Book of the Damned and a couple other places into the Nandal book. I think we talked a little bit more about it, but yeah, the idea sort of is, and I don't know if we said this specifically in print, but the idea is kind of that Dubral was something that existed in a previous reality. And he realized that, going back to your idea, like the universes are cyclical and they start and end, start and end, and start and end. He realized the universe was about to end. He's like, I don't want to do that. I'm going to go like set sort of a time capsule,
yeah,
basically, so that when the next one starts, whatever I reincarnate as will be lured out to get it. And so Dubral was actually never really anything except for like a placeholder for Zonkuthon. And Zonkuthon is, and always was, what Zonkuthon is. So he's kind of a self, it's not quite the same as like time traveling to go back in time to be your own grandfather, but sort of the same.
Well, that is dark and creepy and painful, which is Zonkuthon.
Exactly.
Good job.
On that note, so from Twitch, Darren Caldemeyer asks, five separate dwarven nations were founded around High Helm and the Five Kings Mountains in the decade following Tardis collapse, each ruled by one of five brothers. After 9 years of peace, civil war broke out. What happened to the five brothers?
So to the five brothers is a bit trickier of a question, but there's a lot of there's a lot of dwarven history that goes into the last of our softcover campaign setting books for first edition, Druma, Prophets and Prophecy. Because when we were looking at Druma, it was basically, oh, this has two dates over a 9,000-year period. We should work on that. And we realized that, like, Druma was basically the epicenter of a whole bunch of dwarven society and the like. So it goes into a bunch of the Five Kings Wars and the resolution of that. So dwarves live for a long time, but even then, the Five Kings Wars go on for about 700 years. And so those original brothers would not have been the same ones who would have been there for the Curse Accords in 2332. So yeah, they probably lived and died some unfortunate deaths as they were at each other's throats, would be my best guess.
And to bring it back around to Age of Ashes, part four of Age of Ashes, which Linda Zayas Palmer's writing, takes place in and around the haunted city of Sagarek, which is one of these kingdoms. And I can pretty much say that if you play through that, there's going to be spoilers in this, obviously, secrets.
secrets.
You get to meet one of those original kings, I believe, in that adventure. And he has not weathered the thousands of years well, so there will be some revelations. I just started working on that one, so I don't know what Linda came up with it yet. So that's still secret even for me, but it looks pretty cool.
Linda always seems as though she's really nice and cute, but then you realize there's a dark, devious heart within that woman.
Razmir, is it actually the same person, or is it more like the greatest scam that's ever been perpetrated across a continent or a country, in the sense that Razmir gets old, Razmir dies, somebody else takes up the mantle, and Razmir is eternal?
So we've been talking, like you're saying, like it's been thousands and thousands of years for this whole thing. Razmir is one of the characters that hasn't been around that long. He's pretty new.
I mean, relatively speaking.
Well, relatively speaking.
Oh, yeah. Only a century. Oh, gosh. Yeah,
he's like, that's nothing for some like eternal crazy godhead to endure, right?
Because he is a real god, right?
Yes, absolutely. The understanding that Razmir is Jason Bowman's one of Jason Bowman's characters, and my understanding is that there's so far only been one Razmir. So at some point, I'm sure he'll do more with Razmir. He keeps threatening it. In fact, I think the game that he's running, the Oblivion Oath campaign, is in that region. So yeah, I cannot imagine he would resist the urge to start doing stuff. So keep an eye on that. That's when is that? That's Wednesdays on.
That is Thursdays.
Thursdays. Yep. Oh, that's right. Cool.
But Dread Pirate Razmir, no.
Razmir has a late life crisis. I've been leading a nation. What have I been doing?
Or is less successful.
I could have a mask eye patch.
Or his less successful brother Chad, which we've established canonically in previous Secrets of Galarian.
True.
Yep.
That was going to be my Secrets of Galarian question, is what happened to Chad Razmir?
Oh, he fell down the stairs 37 times.
Yeah, and all 37. He reached enlightenment, didn't like what he found, and just doubled right back down.
Twitch asks, Abrek asks, what woke and freed the Whispering Tyrant? They won't get a chance to play the relevant adventure path, so they are wondering.
What's that question?
What woke and freed the Whispering Tyrant?
What freed him and woke him?
I think this is the assumption that the Whispering Tyrant is officially free. Is
he'll be the first to say he did it him damn self, right? You know? You put your trust in an organization like the Whispering Way, you know? Maybe they try to pull this Carrion Crown together, but it totally doesn't pan out, so damn it, he's got to do it himself. The key that he used, the one thing he finally realized, was when he was imprisoned, he went running and hiding in Gallowspire because he had a fragment of a holy shield in his hand that sort of burned him, and it was awful. Over time, he realized, this is maybe something I can use against my enemies. I can use the positive energy that's here, even though I'm a creature and a master of negative energy, in order to set up repercussions over the world, including one to free my own damn self, because my cultists aren't getting the job done.
I'm sure you get this one every year, but who killed Aridin?
We already covered that one.
Yeah.
I'm sure Razmir would be the first one to say he did it himself.
Yeah. You're also assuming someone killed him. All we have said is that he died, and that's probably all we'll ever say. I mean, at some point in the distant future, if, you know, we have a complete turnover of the staff and I'm in like an old person's home and John is off like somewhere digging up Atlantis and Ron has transcended into the all-powerful...
like Bean of Light?
Yeah, yeah. I didn't say light. I just said all-powerful. Whoever's in charge of Pfizer at that point might decide to do something with it, but it's not going to be us.
Okay. From Twitch, Doc Wash asks, is Silvermount and the tech items in Numeria the result of drift travel in the future Starfinder and some sort of paradox?
I think I can handle this one. Because the whole drift travel thing happens, or is released by Treyone, a couple of years after the gap. And so, although I'm sure there is capacity for somebody's personal campaign to say, lo and behold, it was time travel through the drift that didn't exist yet or wasn't accessible yet to bring the Silver Mount there, that's a few too many loops, and I don't think that that's really a reflection of what actually happened.
And the Iron Gods Adventure Path goes into pretty detail, pretty much great detail about how they got there. It was a combination of another planet with... interstellar capacity, and they ran into the Dominion of the Black, and things went sour. So, yeah, it's the all of that technological stuff did sort of inspire a lot of elements in Starfinder, because obviously that came first, and when we were building Starfinder, we were looking at what did and didn't work before. So,
if it were the case, so my thinking to think through. So, Triune, who gave everybody the drift travel. One piece of Triune is Cassandley. Mm-hmm. If, in fact, Cassandley was involved in the drift travel to send back, I mean, Cassandley would have worked herself very differently than
Cassandley
she did.
Cassandley is her own grandmother. Oh, no, we're not doing this again.
Yep, that'll happen. Deities are complicated.
Yeah.
Next.
Also from Twitch, the Silver Scarab would just like to know some new halfling lore facts.
Oh, halflings.
Yeah, you missed it. I already had my gnome time, so it's already halfling time.
One of the things that we've... So halflings' place has always been sort of in the shadow of humanity, which doesn't mean that halflings sort of as a group with their own ethnicities, simply mirror whatever the humans have. They have their own sort of foci among their people, their own what functions as ethnicity for the halflings. For example, one of the halflings' ethnicity types, the Jareks, are the sort that are sort of they tend to be a little more scrappers. They tend to be more rough and tumble. They will gather together. Community is important to all halflings, but Jareks create. I think they're called Billy bands. They've got a name for like the local toughs that will hang out together. Local tough halflings. Sometimes they'll cause trouble. Sometimes they'll be in places where they're needed. They'll be sort of leading into organizations like the Bellflower Network to sort of help other halflings. But they sort of make the community of their own friends. That type of halfling does that. There's a halfling lore piece.
I'll keep bringing up Age of Ashes because I am doing something else in the Adventure Path panel, so I can't talk about it there. But we've got another absolutely brilliant and amazing author for that one. Ron Lundeen is writing part 3, which is set in Ravenel and Cantargo area and is all about halflings. And one of my favorite bits of lore that Ron and I think your wife helped write some of that?
Yeah.
One of the things that I'm not sure who added this bit of lore into it, but it's pretty cool, is that the Bellflower Network uses kites to send secret messages. So you'll see like a blue kite doing 3 dips to the left and 1 to the right. That means coffee's half off at Laurier Longroads.
The thing you need to remember, though, is that if it's a couple loops to the left and a couple to the right, you want to know who you're signaling. Otherwise, it looks backwards.
Yeah.
And then you're like, to arms! Very well! And you show up like, time to kill all the long chains! And then coffee.
Oh, I was on the left side. Oh, sorry.
No, we got that because they do it at Kite Hill, which is in a specific place outside the city.
Yeah.
So if you're seeing it from the other side, you know you're on the wrong side.
Clever damn halflings.
I'm on to figure it out.
Yeah. I haven't done extensive reading. Most of my exposure to Glorian has been through the Iron Gods campaign, which I very much enjoyed being a player in. But I do wonder, where do the androids come from?
The androids, so the ship, the Divinity is the big ship that crashed into Numeria ages and ages ago. It comes from a planet called Androfa, which is in a different galaxy somewhere far, 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 far away. Androfa is the name of my homebrew planet that a lot of Galarian is based on, so I figured that was a fun little Easter egg to throw in there. That's where androids come from. They were a technological society. They had a lot of, they got like these capital generation ship stuff that they can build, and that's basically where those androids came from. There were already androids on the Divinity, and they had like a big... one of the things that you obviously encountered in Iron Gods is there are like android building factories and stuff like that here and there now crashed all over Galarian. And those things, the ones that are still working are the ones that are churning out the androids that you see on Galarian today. So that's where androids come from. Whether or not that's where they come from in Starfinder, it's that the idea of like an android is kind of universal. And if it gets created on year 1 and then they forget year 5, they'll create them again on year 6. Right, John?
Mm-hmm.
John knows.
I'm on to you.
Are you making androids? Is that it? Is that why you know? Okay.
Nothing.
It's in my new vision for gnomes.
Gnome droids.
From Twitch, Dreadknight57 asks, got any plans for Rahadum? Any secrets you can tell us about Rahadum?
The biggest thing we've done with Rahadum is probably James Sutter's novels. His character Salim is from Rahadum. What are the names of those?
Death's Heretic and the Redemption Engine.
Yeah, those two are the big things we've done with Rahadum so far.
Yeah, we've done a little bit of Pathfinder Society Adventures as well as Pathfinder Adventure Card Guild play there. One of the challenges, though, has definitely always been, and this is some of the stuff conversations I have with James, because anytime we do one of these Pathfinder Society outlines, it goes past James, who, by and large, will stop by and be like, looks good, and then walk off, bomb.
Turns out John knows what he's doing.
Yeah. the couple times we've done stuff in Rahadum, he's always cautioned, like, be careful about how this impacts roughly, like, a third of all the characters, because a bunch of clerics and paladins and druids will go there, and they'll be like, okay, am I able to use my class abilities? In the case of like paladins or certain clerics, am I going to feel inclined to say this is not a representative authority and I don't have to respect it, at which point what happens when a paladin just says, well, I follow Iomide, and if you can't follow Iomide, off with your head. Or do they have to respect the local authorities? Those are all questions that go into these sorts of adventures. So anything that we do with Rahadum has to take in those considerations into the story. And if they can't really take in those considerations, then there's either a chance for things to go south real bad, real fast, which can make for cool adventures sometimes,
sure.
Or it makes for an adventure that is not as viable as we would want it to. It needs to be retooled. So there are always challenges with adventures in Rahadum that we can oftentimes address through the design of the story, but they're part of the equation.
I really like Rahadum and would like to do more with it. I mean, personally, it's one of the areas that really interests me is sort of the fact that they're sort of structured on sort of a grim philosophy in the world they're in. Specifically, to follow up on that, one of the narrative problems with storytelling in that is it is easy to have some or all of your characters be rebels and revolutionaries if what they're opposing is sort of a monolithic evil, right? From, you know, the Aslan Empire Starfinder, or Cheliax. That's much harder to do when the oppressive regime isn't evil. They're not bad people. They've made some decisions and they've sort of enforced their society on that. But you can't be like, oh, I'm the cleric of Caden Kalen. He's going to cast spells like crazy and then overthrow. They're genuinely good people. We're like, wait, overthrow
why do you call them genuinely good people? They're genuinely
good people in Rahadum.
But they're a politically autonomous nation, and if you as adventurers are going to come in and potentially, depending upon what your mix of characters is, be like, white man's burden, gonna give you God. It's gonna be great. We're doing you a favor. That can have some real problematic connotations. Be very presumptuous and basically say, whatever your culture is, this nation, we don't care. But
the fact that that nation's culture is also so anti-specific character class, and arguably one of the most important character class, it'd be like if we did had a nation where magic was illegal, which I don't believe we do.
But not that I know of.
But, you know, in that case, it's like anybody who is a spellcaster can't play in that area unless you're going in there to liberate that nation. So it's just a complicated place to do. And in a lot of cases, unless the adventure is specifically about, like, dealing with this unusual government element, or you're trying to, like, do sort of, like, sneak in and don't get in trouble, adventures that would be set in Rahadum would probably... That's why we have, like, Assyrian and Katabesh, and we've got a lot of other similar terrain to explore in adventures. Next.
So I'm inserting or working on a Temple of Lasala, the Rune Goddess, mm-hmm. into my Res Runelords campaign. The Wisher's Well is what I'm converting it from. I'm having a lot of difficulty understanding how sin magic, or like the idea of using sin, kind of is very, very different from what characters in modern Galarian would know. Could you like give me some insight as to how to understand? Or
It's. I think part of the problem is the phrase sin magic, and that's something that the internet I think has really seized upon, but it's not something we've ever really called it. I mean, it's Thessalonian magic, and it's based on these seven schools of magic, accepting divination, and each one of those is originally associated with one of the virtues of rule, and then kind of a warped version of that is the sin. And it's not that the magic itself is sinful, it's that the rune lords who use this magic basically wallowed in the sin and all of that. So what I would probably suggest is looking at some of the stuff we've done, like Rise of the Rune Lords and Return of the Rune Lords are the two big places we've done a lot of this stuff, Shatterstar to a lesser extent. Looking at adding the sin elements in thematically to the entire adventure rather than tying it specifically to the magic itself, if that makes sense. And with Lasala is kind of a complicated deity anyway, because she started out more kind of lawful neutral and kind of went sour as time went on. And she's not so much the goddess of the seven magic traditions of Thassalon as she is like of just runes overall. There's a lot of rune stuff going on in Thassalon. And
So yeah, even with her elements and stuff like that, what I would probably do is use those seven sins as like themes, kind of like what we did with Return of Rune Lords and Rise of the Rune Lords. Use them as themes to like decide what sort of monsters and encounters and things you want to do in your adventure, and then just make sure you pepper in magic as well, and it'll kind of take care. That's the way I've always done it. It just takes care of itself.
And if you haven't already looked at them, I think you can find some more LaSala resources in AP 65, I think it's the fifth book of Shattered Star, as well as 123, which is the Runes of Aslant, Gods of Aslant article, which has a short write-up for her when she was a lawful neutral Aslanti goddess. So I could shed some more insight.
Yep.
On Twitch, Lava Being wonders, since goblins have a new part to play in second edition, are there any similar updates to the hobgoblins in the Chitterwood or anywhere else in Galarian?
Not really. We've got, with the Iron Fang invasion, one of the things we're caring for with that is that there's going to be an actual nation of hobgoblins in the region. They're still evil. And going back to goblins, there still could, they very much are goblins in the world that are still, you know, they're evil, you know, puppy-eating, house-burning maniacs. The role of goblins as player, it's one of the, it's a weird thing where you can, like, see, like, everybody in the world who is going to be, every party is going to have a goblin player character. But in any one incarnation of your setting, that's one player character out of, like, the entire planet. So it's unless you're getting to, like, organized play, which has a different sort of take on it, it's a tricky thing.
Slightly different demographics.
Yeah. But hobgoblins are we've got a new look for them. We'll probably show off, I think we've shown off a couple of them already. They look more like goblins. And their role is pretty much unchanged, but we're doing more with them.
Yeah. The new hobgoblin nation is switched gears from militaristic conquest. They've sort of hunkered down in order to become to work to become an economic powerhouse, which is no less frightening in its own way.
Because what hobgoblins do when they have money is dangerous.
Mm-hmm. All right, I have a two-part question. Why would anybody still live in Sandpoint? And what did poor Sandpoint do to you guys?
People would live in Sandpoint because it's the best place on the planet. One of the things with... I go into this actually in the Sandpoint book. That basically, the problems with Sandpoint is that this is... That spot of the planet is where Pazuzu and Lamashtu kind of had a fling at one point, way in the ancient past. And then the two of them hated each other. And so they both kind of want, like, they left their mark on this area and they both kind of want it, but they don't want to, like, admit that they had spent time there. So they're kind of, like, squabbling over it. And Sandpoint's kind of caught in the middle there.
So Sandpoint is the restaurant where they had their first date and refused to go anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And then they keep, like, kind of, like, just doing all this to her. So. And so they've got some of their minions, like the Red Bishop, and there's a couple of other characters in the region. They're kind of have put down seeds and are like kind of manipulating place and being, you know, just dangerous and all that. Up until Burnt Offerings, like the couple of years before Burnt Offerings, it was just a quiet little town where nothing really ever happened.
You're about to be until Burnt Offerings. It was a quiet little town. I'm like, but Jervastute.
Well, that was like a year before that. But about that point is when things started getting to a head. And the reason that people would live there is because that's a really great place for you to get experience points.
Do the Red Mantis know Norgorber's real name?
Who says it's not Norgorber? The Red Mantis probably doesn't. Although, they've got that big library down under the Crimson Citadel. We are going to be doing a lot more with Norgorber in the relatively near future, and that's sort of a spoiler that we'll talk about later in a different seminar with Ron talking.
Last question, lightning round.
Oh, yeah.
From Twitch, Aneri Dyes asks, what's the state of Sikoris after Wrath of the Righteous? Is the country rebuilding? Is there anything else to rebuild? Is there anything left, probably?
Oh, there's plenty left. I mean, the idea is that the World Wound has been defeated and is closed at the end of Wrath of the Righteous. But that doesn't mean that's a nice place to live. It just basically means that all of the demons that were living there now can't get away. And they dig in. And but since they can't constantly refuel their numbers, it's now a case of like, if you kill one demon, two pop in to take its place, which was what the previous setting was. Now it's like you kill one demon, there's one less demon to deal with. And so the flavor of the whirlwind, which is now called the Sarkora Scar, the flavor changes from we can't win to we can win. And that's going to be a case of like people going in and trying to reclaim the lost heritage of Sarkoris. Mendev, to a certain extent, also has lost his heritage because all of these crusaders rolled in as like, we'll save you. And they're like, oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, you'll note that a lot of what we've done with Mendev already is basically, here's how they host the crusaders that are fighting against the Whirlwind, but we don't say really anything at all about Mendev. So that's one of the things that is neat about the edition changes, that we get to look at what Sarkoris is, what Mendev is, and explore that. Cool. I think that's all we got time for. Or we can. What is it?
15 till.
15 till.
I don't know when this ends.
So. Yeah. I thought this went till 11. We can do a couple more real quick lightning round questions.
Sure. Any fun facts or plans for Viperwall?
Not off the top of my head, but it's always been a place that I've thought of as a mega dungeon that we could do something with someday.
Do the clockworks from Pan Mahjong, are they amalgam? Amalgams of souls that they fused into the clockwork machines, or is it one soul per robot?
From what I remember, because we explore this in a recent Pathfinder Society scenario, I think that this is a big old pile of souls that then get divvied up.
Scoop up with an ice cream scoop.
Yeah, and then sometimes you get the head of one soul, the feet of another, and then you make a robot out of it.
Okay. That sounds friendly.
That's why they're not friendly.
Oh.
Seth the Sloth asks, do bleachlings actually stop aging altogether? Are they effectively immortal?
No, they can die.
Yeah, bleach gnomes, so like humans, when they get old, they get wrinkled and like kind of stooped over, and we all know what happens. Gnomes, when they get old, they just kind of bleach. That's sort of...
Well, or a gnome who's aging but is not bleaching is still going to go through many of the same steps as a human would. But... Their chance of bleaching increases with age and being able to get out and about.
Yeah, it's not an escape from death.
No.
Okay. Final question then.
All right.
The Silver Scarab asks, if you are an average peasant farmer, where is the worst place in Galarian to live?
Assuming that there are, like, supposed to be peasants there.
I think so.
Okay, so I was going to say the bottom of the ocean.
Let's go with there are supposed to be peasants there and just in general.
Nidal.
Nidal? I'd say maybe Geb.
At that point, you're a zombie.
Well, there's nothing to farm here either.
Irison's bad.
Oh, no, Geb is a food exporter.
That's right. Well, I mean, they're not. Except you're a peasant farmer, you're a zombie.
Yeah.
Isle of Terror is pretty bad.
Yeah.
Shouldn't have peasants.
Last Wall. Ooh.
Last Wall, yeah.
These days.
Yeah.
I'm going to stick with Nidal.
Okay.
Nidal's pretty bad. So is Chuye in Tian Sha, where. Anybody is your neighbor could be an Oni, and you never know until they cut your head off.
And then you know.
Then you know, but you can't tell anyone unless you, I guess, you can be a Penanglin.
Oh, yeah, all of them.
Yay. Cool. Well, I guess that's all we got time for. Thank you, everybody. Nobody asked the questions I thought they would ask, and somebody asked the questions I didn't think they'd ask, which is kind of the way it always goes.
Bam.
What did you think we were
going to
ask?
Next time.
I thought you were going to ask about who the person is that I wasn't going to talk about, but I don't have to talk about that person right now.
But I bet you could ask about it next year or even at Gen
You
Con.
Might hear about that in the Adventure Path seminar.
Yeah.
I think about Q&A.
It's not Dayhawk. There are other dragons in the world. So
you've been writing about other dragons?
Yeah. They're very much more colorful too.
What?
Yeah.
You've been seeing fairy dragons?
They're so sparkly.
Oh, good. You and your cat are good.
Yay.